The Tom Woods Show, episode 2318.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Hey folks, believing that the end of the world might be a bad thing that we should try to avoid is not a Russian talking point. But if we are going to avoid World War III, it's important for Americans to understand what's been left out of the CIA's narrative about Russia and Ukraine. Coming to the rescue here is my brand new free ebook, Your Facebook Friends Are Wrong About Ukraine. Pick it up at wrongaboutukraine.com. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. I am absolutely delighted to be joined by Heather McDonald, who's a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and she is the author most recently of When Race Trumps Merit, How the Pursuit of Equity Sacrifices Excellence, Destroys Beauty, and Threatens Lives. I feel like that subtitle more or less sums up the headlines these days. But Heather McDonald, welcome to the show.
Well, it's great to be with you, Tom. It's wonderful to be talking with you.
You know, I am going to be in London in July, and for the first time ever, I'm going to the Globe. And at the time I'm there, they're performing the Comedy of Errors. And I thought, well, I have two of my daughters with me. Why don't we all go see the Comedy of Errors? And we're still planning to do that. But when we went to get the tickets, we got a, I wouldn't call it a trigger warning, but some kind of a warning that the content here may be insensitive in one way or another. I don't remember the exact warning. And I'll be honest with you, Heather, it's been 32 years since I read The Comedy of Errors, so I don't know what anyone could object to in it. But I remember being a bit demoralized by this because up to now, I had thought, we have crazy people in the universities, we have crazy people in the culture, but you have to admit, when push comes to shove, if you want to see a great Shakespeare company or a great symphony orchestra, you're going to find them in the blue cities after all. So for one reason or another, they are upholding all this. But now, I don't know, maybe not so much, or at least they're starting to feel uncomfortable about it.
Oh man, you way understate things, Tom. There is not a single arts institution in the Anglo world that since the George Floyd death has not been beating its chest and proclaiming in utter falsehood that it is a racist institution and that its mission, whether it's a symphony orchestra, theater company, the Globe Theater Company, the Royal Shakespeare Company, that they are all now dedicated to anti-racism. Museums, Museum of Art, the Tate Modern in London, Metropolitan Museum here, Art Institute of Chicago, and the leaders of these organizations who have been given the supreme privilege of curating and passing on some of the greatest traditions in all of human history that reach heights of sublimity and pathos and expression and wit and irony and eros, rather than being down on their knees in gratitude for these traditions, they have turned on them. And they have declared that any European artistic tradition, whether it's classical music or classical theater, literature, painting, if it came out of Europe, which was historically demographically white, just as Africa was demographically black and China was demographically Chinese, but only the West is now guilty for its demographic past. So any Western art tradition that has historically been created predominantly by white people, because again, this wasn't because of racism and exclusion. It was because Europe was white. It was a Caucasian population. That tradition is now coming down as racist.
Is the situation as bad in Europe as it is in the United States, or is it, as I suspect, maybe 15, 20% worse here?
It's hard to say. Arguably, in some respects, it's worse. The Rijksmuseum in Amsterdam, which is one of the great repositories of the Baroque Golden Age of painting, Rembrandt, Vermeer, Frans Hals, they mounted a show a year or so ago called Slavery that went around putting little wall texts on great masterpieces, berating them for being racist. Their greatest masterpiece in their whole collection is a massive canvas by Rembrandt of the night watchmen, the civil guard in Amsterdam that were knights of the city that protected the city against marauders. And it's a fabulous painting of humanity, extreme acute observation of detail. Well, there's maybe 25 separately characterized individuals in the painting. None of them are Black. And so the Rijksmuseum decides that this is a racist painting. There were maybe, at the time that Rembrandt painted this, and these are real-life portraits, there were maybe 10 Blacks in a city of hundreds of thousands. So in a painting of 25 individuals, if you're going to be proportionally Black to what the Amsterdam population was at that point, you'd have to have like 0.00001% of a Black person in the painting. But this is the type of nonsense that is going on in art museums in Europe, and certainly in English-speaking countries, things are pretty damn bad. But I think your instinct, by and large, Tom, is right, that by and large, it is the United States that has the worst bad conscience and guilt complex about race. And we are tearing down every institution in this country based on the specious charge that if it is not proportionally 13% Black, it's a racist institution.
Let me see if I can give a brief summary of your general thesis. There was and remains a legal doctrine that we know of as disparate impact, according to which if, let's say, as an employer, are requiring as hiring criteria something like demanding that the applicant have a high school diploma or wanting to look at his criminal record or whether he had a dishonorable military discharge or anything of that sort, I would need to prove definitively that that requirement was necessary for an applicant for this job, or otherwise I could wind up in court because all three of those requirements and others have a, quote, racially disparate impact. That is to say, more Black people would be excluded from consideration as a result of those factors than whites would be. And that what we've seen, though, is that this has gone from being a legal doctrine to being the sort of judge, jury, and executioner for the arts, for all institutions, for education, everything across American culture and society is to be put under this particular microscope. Does such and such have a disparate impact? So if the number of Black people attending opera is lower than in the general population, then there's a kind of disparate impact there. And so we have to accuse opera of whatever, of in some way being at odds with the cause of equity at large. So is that more or less what we're seeing?
That's a fabulous summary. That's exactly right. Any standard that has a disparate impact on Blacks, no matter how colorblind, how objective, how non-discriminatory in intent, if it has a disparate impact, that standard is coming down. It is all coming down. The accusation of racism now is the only allowable explanation in our culture for any institution that has racial disparities, the only allowable explanation. The reason, however, for disparate impact is not racism. It is vast disparities in academic skills on the one hand and vast disparities in antisocial criminal behavior on the other that explain overrepresentation of Blacks in prison. And these are difficult things to talk about. Tom, whites do not like to focus on the pathological inner city culture that gives rise to these academic skills gaps and crime gaps. And I understand that racial etiquette. But when we are facing a elite chorus of voices that are trying to tear down every single meritocratic standard because it has a disparate impact, the time for racial etiquette is over. And we have to be honest about the real cause of racial disparities. And I give that data in the book. And we have to be armed with this. But right now, thanks to the fact that, for example, Tom, 66% of Black 12th graders do not possess even partial mastery of 12th grade basic skills, such as being able to do arithmetic or recognizing a linear function on a graph. 66% of Black 12th graders are below basic, and only 7% are even competent, and the number of Blacks 12th graders who are advanced in math is too small to show up statistically. When that is the reality, to say that if Google does not have 13% Black engineers or computer scientists is preposterous. The numbers aren't there in the pipeline. And so here's the sad reality. You can have meritocracy or you can have diversity. You cannot have both. And we have decided that we are going to destroy meritocracy in order to engineer through racial quotas and through discriminating against the most qualified applicants for a job. We would rather have diversity.
Heather, reading your book made me want to revisit an article I myself wrote quite a long time ago when I was in college, because when I was in college, that was 1990 to 94, the idea of faculty diversity was very much in vogue. I was at Harvard, and there was a group called Students at Harvard Against Racism and Ethnocentrism, which gave us the acronym SHAIR. And they said this: the scarcity of minority faculty indicates a racism that pervades the university. So they were claiming that racism pervaded Harvard. So at the time I wrote this, I was not removed from the university for writing this. This was a very tolerant time in the early 90s. But I wrote this, that according to a National Academy of Sciences report in 1988, of the 608 PhD degrees awarded that year in mathematics and computer sciences, two were earned by Black students. Nearly 500 students earned doctorates that year in earth, atmospheric, and marine sciences. Again, two were Black. Five Blacks earned doctorates in American history, even counting African American history. 11 earned doctorates in economics, 5 in anthropology, 7 in political science, and 14 in sociology. Not a single doctorate was awarded to a Black student in astronomy, astrophysics, botany, classics, comparative literature, demography, ecology, European history, geography, immunology, and Arabic, Chinese, German, Italian, and Russian languages and literature. So given that that's the fact of the matter, it is not the case that Harvard's lack of a Black professor of German languages and literature reflects racism. It reflects the reality of the numbers of the PhDs available.
That's hilarious. I have the exact same data in my book. If they'd listened to you, I wouldn't have had to write this damn book. I give the updated numbers. It's the exact same thing. 2020, 2021, we have federal data on PhD attainment. Same thing. There's like one or two Blacks graduating in fields of physics, math, chemistry, engineering. In many fields, I list the ones, you know, specific areas of physics that have zero. As it's the exact same problem. They're not in the pipeline. We have the same thing with law partnerships. It's everywhere. They're not in the pipeline because of skills gaps that you do not solve at the PhD hiring level. There's nothing that a university can do about it. And yet we have been engaged in this unbelievable fiction for 30 or 40 years that we are pretending that the problem is our standards of excellence. That's not the problem. The standards should be met. They should be striven for by all groups. Tearing down the standards is only going to subject all of society to mediocrity. It is going to put lives at risk, whether it's in emergency room doctors or are now tearing down criminal law enforcement. And we are so unwilling to look hard at the anti-acting white culture, at the family breakdown in the inner city. We turn our eyes away from these barbaric drive-by shootings and we say the problem is with the rest of us, and we are all going to make sure that there's not a single straight white male hired again in the theater world or the art world or ideally at Google or Facebook. But that's, again, the problem. We had a very bad racial past. It is sickening. It is heartbreaking. It is hypocritical. But we are not that country today. We are not systemically racist. The reality is not white privilege. The reality is Black privilege. There's not a single mainstream institution that is not tying itself into knots to find, hire, and promote as many remotely qualified Blacks as possible. That is the reality of every faculty search. It is the reality of every law firm, every effort at getting Black partners. That is the reality. Nobody's going around pretending to be white in order to get a job. I can guarantee you that.
And yet, if this were a, quote, white supremacist society, you would think they would. You would think on college applications, people would want to pretend to be white so they could get their white privilege. Or you would think that being called a white supremacist would be a badge of honor. But of course, instead, it destroys somebody's career to be called a white supremacist, which is precisely why they use the term. But this all goes to show that this is not, the problem is not quote unquote white supremacy. And isn't it funny? White supremacy was a term you would have used in the 1960s to refer to people who wanted to preserve segregation. And I would say it was, what was it, maybe 10 or 12 years ago that they, or maybe even sooner, that they revived the term because racist was starting to lose its appeal. I mean, everybody was being called racist. So all of a sudden, white supremacist made a comeback at a time when, as I say, if this were a white supremacist society, there wouldn't be a massive civil rights anti-discrimination division in law. I feel sometimes that I'm living in a completely different universe, factually and morally, from people on the other side of things. And so I find myself like in conversations like this, repeating obvious facts and then stopping and asking myself, why am I doing this? Everybody knows this is true. And the other side is just going to ignore me.
God, I have that exact same experience all the time. It is shocking to come across the thinking, you know, person to person of the other side. And I ask myself all the time, I don't want to commit errors of inconsistency, epistemological problems of seeing double standards only on the other side, demonize the other side. They see us probably through the same light, although I'm not sure. I don't know whether the left accuses the right of double standards, which is what we say all the time, or whether they just say racist. But how can they not see these skills gaps? And I would say you're right that white supremacist is a favorite term now. But you don't even need to be supremacist. These days, to be called white is enough to cancel somebody. All the New York Times needs to do to immediately put a very, very dark cloud of suspicion over an individual or an institution is to add white to its description. If you're reading a story about a crime and the race of the criminal is not identified, you can assume it's black, because if the criminal had been white, it would have been noted.
It would almost have been celebrated.
Well, true, because the fact of the matter is that violent street crime today of drive-by shootings and robberies in many cities, the face of that crime is exclusively black or Hispanic. And that's why the media freaked out so much at the Enjoy with the shooting rampage in Atlanta of the Asian spas of this white Christian. And they, again, were forced to live this fiction that this was due to white supremacy and anti-Asian hatred. Whereas, in fact, this was a young man who was tormented by sexual guilt because of his Christian beliefs. And the fact that he was going after Asian prostitutes had nothing to do that they were Asian had nothing to do with it. He was on his way to Florida to a studio that made porn to continue his rampage. They were not Asian down there. But we were supposed to pretend that the actual wave of anti-Asian violence was committed by whites, when the videos from San Francisco and Los Angeles and New York City show again and again, it's groups of black teenagers that are ruthlessly pummeling these elderly Asians, stomping on them, beating them. And we have the video evidence right before our eyes. And yet the discourse is that this is a white on Asian problem.
Hey, everybody, quick message from our friends at Policy Genius. I know intellectually you understand the importance of caring for your loved ones after you're gone. We all understand that. But for some reason, sometimes we just don't do it, because we think it's going to be too expensive or too time-consuming, or we just don't want to think about unpleasant things. But you got to do it, because those expenses are going to keep on coming relentlessly after you're gone. With a wife and five daughters, I have tremendous peace of mind having life insurance. And it was way less expensive for way more coverage than I thought possible. Well, you have a secret weapon when it comes to getting life insurance, and that is Policy Genius. Policy Genius was built to modernize the life insurance industry. And using their technology, you can easily compare life insurance quotes from America's top insurers in just a few clicks. and thereby find your lowest price. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $25 per month for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer coverage in as little as a week and avoid unnecessary medical exams. No added fees, your personal details are private, thousands of five-star reviews on Google and Trustpilot can't be wrong. And don't forget, Policy Genius's licensed agents work for you, not the insurance companies, so they can give you impartial advice and recommendations. You can trust their guidance. Your loved ones deserve a financial safety net. You deserve a smarter way to find and buy it. Head to policygenius.com. or click the link in the description or on the show notes page to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com. A couple more small details I want to make sure I hit before going further. Just there's so many items in your book that could make for entire episodes. For instance, I think it's fairly well known. I don't know if this is true of all symphony orchestras or just some, whereby the audition process is behind a screen precisely to eliminate the possibility of bias. And you had somebody in your book, I don't remember who, suggesting that in the name of equity, they should get rid of the screen, which was introduced precisely for the sake of making sure everybody had an equal shot and just being the best violin player or whatever.
It's not just a somebody, Tom. It's the leading classical music critic in the entire country, Anthony Tomasini, who is the critic for the New York Times. Arguably, maybe Alex Ross of the New Yorker is of comparable influence and stature. But it was Anthony Tomasini who, after George Floyd, said we should consider taking away the screen so that orchestras can hire on the basis of race because orchestras are too white. Well, actually, what they are is disproportionately Asian, but that doesn't absolve any institution from the charge of white privilege. But that nonsensical assertion that somehow a blind audition is racist can be used as a metaphor for the entire way we're thinking about things. We say that as well about colorblind, computer-graded, objective tests of academic skills like SATs or LSATs. It's a computer grading it. The computer doesn't know the race of the test taker. Those grades are objective. And yet we say that's a racist test. Or red light cameras. If red light cameras show that blacks are speeding more or running red lights, the camera doesn't know the race of the driver, but we say the camera must be racist. So anything that is objective, neutral, colorblind, constitutional, that nevertheless has a disparate impact on blacks, not because of the standard, but because of the underlying behavior, is now in the crosshairs and is being torn down as a racist standard.
Before we talk about crime, which I want to get to in a minute, I also want to say something about your discussion of, for example, but not confined to, the American Medical Association, because we started to see several years ago a series of manifestos coming out from various professional organizations taking radically left-wing positions on race and on what white society must do in order to bring about justice. And we saw this with the American Medical Association. Can you just comment on that? I mean, I don't even need to set this up any further, I don't think.
Well, they are bellwethers of our American society and the radical ideological transformation that America has gone through from the 1950s to today. The American Medical Association, the leading professional voice of doctors, sets policy, negotiates with Congress, but represents the best scientific tradition. In the 1950s, was regarded as a bastion of Midwestern Republican sort of upright values, very middle-class bourgeois. It was against socialized medicine, probably was against Medicare, you know, as too big a government expansion, and boy, was it right. And today, the AMA is indistinguishable from a Black Studies department. It's like it's got Ibram Kendi writing its press releases. It came out with this equity plan in 2021 that is just one indigestible racial bromide about intersectionality and white privilege, and doctors need to go to re-education camp, and medicine is a racist enterprise. It is astounding, and it's not just the AMA. It is our leading medical journals, the Journal of the American Medical Association, JAMA, which was a place for the publication of cutting-edge medical research that would allow doctors to keep up on the latest developments in their field. Lancet, another medical journal published in Britain, the Scientific American. They have all come out, and they come out constantly, with special issues on racism in medicine, racism in the police, racism if you think that obesity is a health problem, and the ideas that science itself is an inequity-producing enterprise. These are lies. These are utter lies, but they are pressing for more racial quotas in medical school admissions, in medical school hiring for faculty, in hospitals, in research labs. Again, the standards are coming down in order to engineer racial diversity.
Well, the difficult thing, of course, is trying to imagine a way forward, because everyone is cowed by being called a racist. And the thing is that the people who use this language, or white supremacists, I'm not exactly sure if in their heart of hearts they realize that this is just a shakedown operation, and probably the victims of their name calling aren't really hateful people. But what they know is that the average person doesn't want to be called a hateful person. The average person doesn't want people to think, well, I'm just arbitrarily cruel to people for no reason at all. No one wants that, because I think most people look at the average person with goodwill. If they have no other reason to have bad will towards somebody, they have goodwill toward them. So to be called this, it makes people become defensive. But on top of that, of course, are the professional repercussions. Because, of course, if in your profession it gets around that you are alleged to be a quote-unquote racist, well, not only will your feelings be hurt, but that could be the end of it for you. So that means that anybody who has half a bit of sense on any of these questions winds up staying quiet for the sake of preserving his livelihood. And it's very hard to see a way out of that. Do you?
Yes. And those are two separate issues. On the first, I would say there is a way out, and just say, I'm not going to be cowed. You can call me a racist all you want. I know what the facts are. I know what the truth is. And I'm just going to wait you out. But on the professional repercussion issue, that is a much harder question. I finished the book with an exchange I'd had with an oncologist who told me about the fact that the head of the National Cancer Institutes, this is the federal funding agency that funds about 35 cancer research centers across the country, mostly affiliated with leading university medical centers. And National Cancer Institutes give every year what they call their Outstanding Investigator Awards. And these are given to the most promising cancer researchers that are doing the most cutting-edge work that is high risk. It may not pan out, it's sort of radical in its theories, but if it does, it's going to be hugely, hugely beneficial. And these are generous awards that allow like 6 years of time off from faculty teaching, and they fund a lot of research assistants. Well, the usual problem, the awardees for these Outstanding Investigator Awards have not been sufficiently Black. And so the head of the National Cancer Institute, or the deputy director, sent out a notice to all of the cancer centers saying, problem with diversity here, please send us a more diverse group of nominees. In other words, choose on the basis of race so that we then can choose on the basis of race. And I said to this oncologist who lives to cure cancer, that is his life's mission, when are you guys going to stand up and say, we're not taking this anymore? We want to be able to do our work without being accused of racism and without having to lower our standards. And he wrote back and he said, I want my job. I need my job. We need our jobs. If we speak out, we get crushed. The people who've spoken out have been crushed. The whole system is going to have to collapse. It'll take about 50 years and then it'll be rebuilt from ground up. But that is the fear. And so I'm searching for solutions for that professional repercussion thing myself. And I came up with one very tentative proposal of a central organization that would be not affiliated with any particular organization, but that would go to bat for anybody that is facing this spurious charge of racism, by giving the facts. This is the academic skills gap. This is why this institution is not proportionally diverse or Black. I'm not sure that would work, but that's the tough issue. But I think if enough people say, I'm not going to be cowed, they can pick us off one by one or not. I mean, you refuse to bend. At some point, maybe there will be a critical mass that will be willing to defend our standards and say, we're not going to allow Western civilization to be canceled.
I'd like to shift gears a minute and not take up too much of your time. This is the release day of your book, and I want to be respectful of your time. But I want to talk about crime. And in particular, could you define for us what was meant by the term criminal justice reform? Because we heard that quite a bit. And no, look, I think there are problems with the police as much as there are with any government agency. Inherently, a government agency has inefficiencies, bad rules, cruelties, whatever. I will find that in any agency because that's just the way government is. Ludwig von Mises taught us that. But it seems to me, my gut tells me, without having studied the matter very closely, that, quote, criminal justice reform was a cause, and I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, that some conservatives and libertarians thought this will inoculate me against charges of racism. Because look, I favor criminal justice reform. If you think that is going to keep you from being called a racist, you do not understand how this game is played. But all the same, what exactly constituted criminal justice reform?
Another great question. Hilarious. I share your perplexity. It was absolutely an umbrella term that was mostly about virtue signaling because the whole idea was based on a whole set of falsehoods. First, you start with the idea of mass incarceration, that somehow the United States has just turned into this machine for putting people into prison. It's true. We have a higher, much higher per capita incarceration rate than other Western industrial countries. Why? If you look at our gun homicide rate for certain ages, it's like 24 times the rate of Germany. Japan, a country of 150 million people, has, I think, like 6 homicide victims a year. We have like 20,000, 16,000 to 20,000. These drive-by shootings where these young teenagers are going out and willy-nilly spraying bullets across a sidewalk in the hope of taking out a gang rival or somebody who's dissed their girlfriend of the day. It's a uniquely an American phenomenon. So it turns out that there is not mass incarceration. Prison remains a lifetime achievement award for persistence in criminal offending. You have to work very hard at burnishing your criminal record to get a big city DA interested in you. He's otherwise just going to say, yeah, go, here's a little slip. Maybe we'll see you next week. But because our prison population is disproportionately overrepresented by Blacks, Blacks are 13% of the population. They're about a third of the total prison population of state and federal prisoners. We've decided that our criminal justice system is racist. It must be racist. The police must be racist. When they learn this racism, when it happens, is it in the academy? Is it in the rookie when they're doing their in-service training? Never quite explained, but that's the assumption. We're not allowed to look at crime rates. We're not allowed to look at victimization rates. So criminal justice reform, it's also limited by the fact that most criminal laws are state and local. The federal government, the Congress, can make federal laws and can change federal laws, but the federal prison population is about 12% of the nation's prisons. 88% are state prisoners. So it really was mostly about symbolic changes based on fictions like, oh, most people are in prison for drug possession. Wrong. Most people are in prison for violent crime and serious theft. Drug possession is a minute part of the prison population. But yes, it was a way of saying we're going to be on the side of Black criminals rather than Black victims, because that's the weird thing about the whole Black Lives Matter activist movement. Activists have decided that they care more about Black criminals than they do about Black victims.
I want to read one paragraph, if I may, from, let's see, page 252 of your book, because it reveals just how often mainstream narratives are telling us really 180 degrees the opposite of the truth. And so you say this, Biden, the mainstream media, and Democratic politicians claim that demographic angst is driving whites to paroxysms of violence. As Biden himself said in 2015, a, quote, unrelenting stream of immigration, nonstop, unquote, was eliminating the white majority population share. If whites were lashing out against this immigration-fueled shift in U.S. culture, you would think Los Angeles would experience a particularly disproportionate level of white-committed hate crimes, since whites are only 28% of the L.A. population and Hispanics are 49%, but that is not the case. Blacks committed anti-Hispanic hate crimes in Los Angeles at 13.5 times the rate of whites in 2021. Now, I sometimes think an interesting way of assessing the role of the media in shaping people's perceptions is through polling and asking people what they think the number of X or Y are. So, for example, during COVID, what do you think the percentage likelihood is of somebody being diagnosed with, quote, COVID and requiring hospitalization? Well, I mean, Democrats were saying something like 40 or 50%. It's not even close. Not even close. Well, likewise, if you were to say, well, what do you think the numbers are on interracial hate crimes and who's the greater percentage perpetrator, you'd get the exact opposite.
Yep. I know. And it's the same with police shootings as well. Like, how many blacks are shot by the police each year? Liberals are going to say like 10,000, 100,000, maybe a million. The number of blacks that are shot by the police each year is 250 on average, almost all of those armed and dangerous. How many unarmed blacks are shot by the police each year? In 2021, that would be 7 out of a black population of 44 million. Who's got a greater chance of being killed? A police officer being killed by a black person or an unarmed black person being killed by a police officer? A police officer is 400 times more likely to be killed by a black than an unarmed black is to be killed by a police officer. But yeah, people's perceptions are fueled by the media narrative, by the academic narrative that says that whites are everywhere the problem. They are oppressing blacks. Biden said this constantly, that, and Obama did as well, that black parents are right to fear every time their child walks outdoors, that that child would be killed by a cop. A fiction, another fiction. The fear that they should have is some teen growing up without a father in a community without fathers who has not been socialized is going to kill their child. Black children died of gun homicide at 100 times the rate of whites after the George Floyd race riots. They're not being killed by the police and they're not being killed by whites. They're being killed by other blacks.
Well, on that note, maybe we'll wrap up on this item, but your chapter 16, which is called A Grim and Ignored Body Count, is indeed profoundly grim. It is relentless, this chapter. It is just with dates in chronological order, I think maybe in reverse order, but day after day after day, this horrible thing happened, this horrible shooting happened, and then this, and then this, and then this, and then this, and it goes on and on and on and on. And you point out that the culture of anti-snitching means that even when your neighborhood is suffering from little kids getting shot in the head, you still won't snitch on who did it because you just can't snitch.
Yeah, it's just amazing to me. Like, what are the shootings that get coverage? And this would be one thing that the media could rightly say is racist. The media itself is racist. If there were white kids getting shot at the rate at which black kids are getting shot, and white kids are basically not getting shot, except for the very, very rare school shooting that takes white kids, and because most school shootings are, once again, gang shootings. If white kids were getting shot like black kids are in their backyards, front porches, bedrooms, at children's birthday parties, there would be a revolution. But the press basically does not believe that Black Lives Matter because these kids are being shot on a regular basis, weekly basis, and nobody hears about it. It's just amazing. These are heartbreaking killings. If the child has not been shot dead with a bullet through the head, instead the child will be paralyzed for life with a bullet through the head. And we all turn our eyes away from it because if we talk about Black victims, that means we're going to have to talk about Black criminals because they're not being shot by the police. And so we'd rather not talk about them at all than talk about Black crime. It's a perverse, perverse decision.
What would you, and we indeed will wrap up on this, but what would you ideally want an office seeker to say about not just the crime question, but the overall thesis of your book? What would you want him to say that would be, let's say, at least plausible to imagine somebody saying that you think might potentially advance the conversation? And I really hate to use the word conversation in this context, because every time we're told we need to have a national conversation on race, we know what that means. It's going to be a monologue. It's going to be a soliloquy that we sit in the audience for. If you really want to have a conversation, both sides would talk. And of course, that doesn't happen. But to facilitate the conversation, what would be the first step? What would somebody of prominence need to say?
Well, I totally share your sense of being nauseated by the term conversation. It's so academic. It's so prissy. It's completely revolting. I would say when it comes to police chiefs, they're letting their police officers twist in the wind of this phony charge of racism. Police chiefs, sheriffs, they should be holding weekly press conferences, giving the facts about where crime is happening, where the 911 calls are coming from, where the shot spotting technology is picking up shootings, to say, yes, we're arresting and stopping Blacks disproportionately. Why? Because we're being sent to Black neighborhoods to protect Black lives, because that's where the victims are. We don't make these choices. We are not deliberately saying, let's oversaturate Black neighborhoods. The only reason we're there is because that's where the violent crime is happening. And that's where the good law-abiding members of those communities, themselves Black, beg us for more police protection. So on the crime front, I would have the police chiefs give the facts. The public is clueless about how disparate the crime rates are. And if it is a larger than, if you've got riots, the mayor should be talking about that. The governor should be talking about that. On the meritocratic standard front, they've got to also bite the bullet, swallow hard, and say that our standards for going to college in this state are not racist. Without racial preferences, if we would not have proportional representation at the most elite colleges, that's because of the skills gap. We're going to do better on that. But frankly, it's also up to parents. Yes, we can have better schools and higher standards for teachers. Of course, that will have a disparate impact. Instead, we're doing the opposite. We're lowering standards for teaching, already the lowest SAT average profession in the country. These are people that barely know how to read themselves in many cases. But we're lowering them further in order to have a more diverse teacher force, exactly the wrong direction to be taking. But I would say that political leaders also have to give the facts, and they just have to not be cowed by the racism charge and say that we have a terrible past, that is true, but we're not that country today, and we are going to push forward with our essential institutions of government, whether it's the criminal law system, due process of law, expectations of fairness in the arts or in science, that we're going to press forward and preserve our strengths.
Well, the book we've been discussing is When Race Trumps Merit, How the Pursuit of Equity Sacrifices Excellence, Destroys Beauty, and Threatens Lives, released just today and written by our guest, Heather McDonald. Well, Heather, best of luck with it. I've got it linked on our show notes page. This is episode 2318. So it's tomwoods.com/2318. Thanks so much.
My pleasure, Tom. It's a great conversation. And thank you for reading the book.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free. And we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.